It's always good to be with you. And thank you for the greeting and the welcome that you've given me. It was good to be clapped in. And I have no doubt there will be those who, when they're away from here, will also say, "He's a bit clapped out." I've been on quite an interesting journey this week with what I'm preaching about. Let me tell you how I come to arrive at a particular subject which I'm going to preach on. Now, sometimes, not that often, if I'm honest, you get a flash of inspiration and you feel that God is laying a particular conviction upon you to preach on a certain topic. That hasn't happened to me. When that hasn't happened, what I usually do is to follow the topic which is preached as part of a preaching plan at our own church. And I'm saying this and introducing it this way because it may seem a rather interesting and different book, which I don't think preachers preach on terribly often. It will be from the Old Testament. I shall take the reading in a moment. But it rather struck me that when we were meeting just before the service started and we were praying, Jeff particularly voiced the feeling that he would like things within the service this morning to be full of joy, and that what is said and what is done is something that would be an occasion of joy. Now, as I come to the reading this morning, I have to say that I was sorely tempted, but I thought it might have been a little bit over the top because it is going to be quite a challenging look at what is something, a particular Old Testament book. But I was very tempted to send a little picture to Jeff to get displayed on the overhead projector saying adult content. I'm going to be reading from the Old Testament and from the book of Esther. I will be making some reference in a little while to the New Testament and a particular part of the New Testament. But I'm going to be reading from Esther and chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay on sackcloth and ashes, and I'll explain why in a few moments. When Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of the sackcloth, but he wouldn't accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa to show to Esther, and explain it to her. And he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court, without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. There are many times, particularly when you walk the Christian path, when a whole series of events will seem to happen, in themselves perhaps not very significant, but when you piece them together, you can often sense that there is a pattern of God working within things. Some years ago, quite a number of years ago in fact, there was a young vicar who had just gone out into ministry. He was taking his first church. I'm not quite sure whether that was as a curate or as a vicar. But he was taking a funeral, and it was a funeral which affected him profoundly. What had happened was that there was a 14-year-old girl who had committed suicide. And the reason that she'd committed suicide was that her monthlies had just started. And quite clearly, nobody in her family had explained what was going on. She had presumed that she'd contracted some sort of sexual disease, couldn't share it with anybody, and committed suicide. And that left this young vicar absolutely distraught. And it affected very profoundly the rest of his ministry and also the lives of many people afterwards. For some 18 years, this bugged him all through his ministry. Then one particular week he was away on holiday. He was in Belgium and he received a phone call. And the phone call came from the church of St. Stephen Walbrook in London. Now, this is where something else quite unrelated at the time was going on. When you look at the churches in London, central London, many of them simply don't have a local congregation. They tend to be centres that people will travel in all around because of the quality of preaching, because of things that are going on in the life of that church, which perhaps are different and which perhaps you couldn't get away with in the average local church. And interestingly, the governance of the church, and don't ask me how this came about because I haven't got a clue, the governance was by not deacons, not elders, not people who seemingly had some kind of church office, but by the Worshipful Company of Grocers. I'm not quite sure what the connection is there, but that's how it came about. But however, it was a church which was got some kind of life within it, and they wanted to extend their ministry. And my guess is that this young vicar has been quite passionate and had touched lives, and they'd heard about him. And so in Belgium, the phone call invited him to come and to do some ministry within the church. So he met up with the Worshipful Company of Grocers. And he had a vision. And that vision is something which over about 18 years had really grown within him. What he wanted to do, he was very conscious of the fact that when people are in an emergency situation, you can dial the number 999 and you can, of course, then summon fire, police and ambulance to your assistance. And his vision was that he would be able to set up a work which was able to have a number, a memorable number, which people who were thinking of committing suicide could dial, and somebody would be on the other end, on the other end, who would listen to them without condemning them, letting them speak, and could be there and come alongside them quite anonymously. Along with that vision, he had quite an interesting thought that the number that he wanted for that particular work was the number M-A-N, because since those days, it wasn't all numbers, you had letters, those of you who can remember telephone numbers going back a fair number of years, M-A-N 9000. Well, he decided that he would talk with the Worshipful Company of Grocers about his vision, which he did, and he felt at that stage probably it was pushing things a little bit, because they agreed that they would go ahead with this, to ask them if they would change the number of St. Stephen Walbrook to Man 9000. So he was given the place in the crypt, and he set his office up there, and they put a telephone extension down for him. And as he began to get things together, he suddenly looked at the telephone, and would you believe it? The number of the telephone was Man 9000. And the result of this was the setting up of a work by Dr. Chad Vara, who had founded something called the Samaritans, a work that is still going today, a work which has influenced and saved many lives, a work on which many other works have been modelled as well. Wasn't God in that particular work, and all a number of unrelated things had come together. And when we look at the story of Esther, again we see the same situation going on. There are a number of unrelated or seemingly unrelated things which are going on when you go through the book of Esther, which bring together a great deliverance for the Jews. In the early months of every year, the Jews celebrate something called the Feast of Purim, which commemorates the story of Esther in the Old Testament. And the story of Esther is best understood as being like the founding of the Samaritans, that series of events which links two major historical things together with five particular characters. Now, the first event is somewhere around about 590 BC. Now, somewhere around about 590 BC, the Babylonians, the Babylonian Empire, wanted to take the southern kingdom of Judah, the capital of which was Jerusalem. They'd besieged the city, and it was fairly evident that it was going to be taken. The prophet Jeremiah, of course, was very active at this time, because he was informing the people there that actually God was going to let this happen. And if you go through the book of Jeremiah, there is a lot of interaction between people who didn't want to accept what Jeremiah was saying. And eventually, of course, the city was conquered, and the Babylonians took into exile into Babylon, not the whole nation, but they took away the people who had the capability to lead the nation, the movers and the shakers, the people who were the managers, the leaders, the people who had got what it takes to build up great works within the economy and the leadership of the nation. the scriptures give varying accounts of the numbers taken away. They vary from about 5,000 to 12,000. It's very hard to say exactly what the numbers are, how they were actually counted. They may have included just the males. They may have included in the larger numbers the ladies and the children, whatever. They were taken away into exile in Babylon. And of course there is one of the Psalms, is the Knot, which says, by the waters of Babylon we wept. And there's a pop group made a song about this. Some of you may know it. I won't ask you to sing it. But this was something which was highly traumatic, and it was very formative in the understanding and the relationship of God and the Jews. But the second event, it wasn't really an event as such. It was really a period of time, and this was sort of in the area of about 540 BC. And very gradually, the Jews were allowed to return because the Persian Empire had conquered Babylon, and in consequence, they were much more open to allowing the Jews to return, which was a very gradual process. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah actually touch on this period of return. Not all the leaders returned, because within the time period they had been there, and that's sort of somewhere around about 70 years, a lot of things were going on. I don't suppose for one moment people who had got the intellect, the drive and the ability simply sat down by the waters of Babylon and twiddled their fingers. Quite evidently, there was commerce going on, there was leadership going on, there were contacts being made. So life was going on, and when the return happened, not all of the Jews returned, only some of them did. A substantial number, but some still remained in exile, and it may well be that Esther was one of those people who remained behind. Now let's look at the characters. Now if you go through the book of Esther, we start off by looking at the king himself. Sometimes the name of the king is given as King Artaxerxes, and if you find that a difficult name to get your tongue round, sometimes he's called Ahasuerus, and I'm going to just call him the king. He was a typical Middle Eastern despot whose word and whim were law. And sometimes, of course, if you want to stress the permanence of something, you will say something like, this is written in the laws of the Medes and the Persians. That's when you want to say something is quite immovable. So first of all, we've got the king, a very powerful man. And we'll see a little bit more of his character coming out in a moment. Secondly, in the first chapter of Esther, we meet up with the queen, Queen Vashti. But she doesn't stay in the story very long. But because she's in it to start with, the rest of the characters emerge. Because what was happening was the king decided he was going to have a feast. And this is, of course, where we start to think in terms of the adult content of this story. Because for feast, we have to read probably the word orgy, because what he was really asking her to do was to come to this party, to which it invited a lot of nobles and a lot of other people, and it says within the book to display her, which means, of course, what he was really saying was, come along and she'll do a sort of strip show for you. So in consequence, Vashti decides, no, I'm not having this. She stood up to him. And then a plot emerges where the king gets all his advisors together, and they manage to find an excuse to throw her out. So she's disposed. But the problem is, what do you do about it afterwards when she's gone? Because then he's got no queen. Let's go then to the next character, and that's Mordecai. Now, Mordecai was a Jew. He was quite clearly a very successful businessman. He's someone who had managed to develop contacts in high places. And this comes out in the story very strongly. Because at one point, Mordecai discovers that there is a plot to assassinate the king. So he must have been mixing with people at a very, very high level indeed. It suggests he was very successful in business and probably was somebody who also attracted a great deal of envy. When he exposed the plot to assassinate the king, it did him a great deal of good. He got the king's favour. He was somebody who was very much someone for the king to be grateful about. So he was doing not only well in his business, he was doing very nicely in the king's favour. He was also a devout Jew. And an edict went out that the gods of the Persians are got to be worshipped. But this brought him into conflict with the fourth character, Haman. Haman was what we today would call a vizier, a grand vizier, a sort of senior and influential civil servant. And you know, very often when you look at business and businessmen and civil servants, they can come into kind of conflict with each other. Because your businessmen have to earn their living by the work of their hands, by their ability to conduct their business well. Civil servants, of course, get paid out of taxes, and it's not quite the same, and tensions emerge, and this is absolutely typical. And in all probability, I'm guessing that Mordecai and Haman had clashed. And what Mordecai managed to engineer was an edict against the Jews who were refusing to worship the Persian gods. And he managed to get them condemned, and that edict went out where they were going to be slaughtered, which was why he was in sackcloth and ashes. So a very nasty situation has emerged. Which brings us to the fifth character, and the heroine of the story, and the cousin of Mordecai. That's Esther. Now, of course, when Vashti was deposed, the king wanted another queen. And he didn't go and get somebody from his household or somebody who was near to him. The process wasn't particularly uplifting. He got what was a kind of beauty parade going on, where all the eligible ladies of the land were obviously viewed by the king. They were selected, and they were pampered for a period of time, so that at the end of that period of time, he could have the queen of his choice. It wasn't really a beauty parade at all that he was going into. And somehow or other, Esther got into the beauty parade and was chosen as queen. Now, while this is going on, Haman extends his plot against Mordecai to kill all the Jews, and the king agrees to go along with the plot. And things are beginning to look pretty ominous for Mordecai and the Jews. Well, as it happened, although Esther was within the confines now of the palace of the king, Mordecai had contact with her. And that contact was really through servants within the palace. So he was able to have that contact with her. And it's at this point that within that contact, Mordecai then informs and challenges Esther about the plot against the Jews. And as we read this morning, he challenges her to expose the plot to the king. And it's at this point we hear the words which have resonated down the centuries almost as a calling, a rallying call to believers. Who knows if you haven't come into the kingdom for such a time as this? And so eventually the story continues. At great risk to herself, Esther explains to the king what is going on, reminding him, of course, of how Mordecai has saved his life in the past, and eventually the king has Haman executed and the Jews are pardoned. So all goes very well in that sense. And putting the story like that, it's a lovely story. It's a story of deliverance. It's a story that is celebrated by the Jews. But there's rather more to it than that. It's a great deliverance, yet nobody comes out of this story, with the possible exception of Vashti, nobody comes out of it completely unblemished. Vashti comes out best in one way because she rebelled against a system she'd been raised in, and she wasn't going to be the star of the king's strip show. The king, of course, a typical potentate, is despotic, probably to some extent is depraved, is domineering, is everything that is the worst thing that a despot can be. Haman, of course, quite simply, is the arch-villain. He's ambitious, he's underhand, he's merciless, he's hateful, particularly hateful towards the Jews. But then we come to Mordecai. Now, Mordecai is a bit of a mixture. He was torn between being a collaborator and an Orthodox Jew. He was also prepared to put Esther under pressure, the response of which could have been that she lost her life. And also, it wasn't just that he was putting her under pressure. He would have been aware that what he was asking her to do was to use her sexuality to persuade the king. So that is something which is quite serious. And Esther, the heroine of the story, was both gloriously heroic in one sense, but also she'd been milking the system by her sexuality, because quite clearly, when people were looking for people, for ladies to take to the king's beauty parade, as it was, it wouldn't have been particularly difficult for her to have made herself look particularly unappealing. She'd milked the system, and that would have been very explicit at times. And that then raises another issue. It's a great deliverance, but it poses a big question. The book of Esther is one of only two books in Scripture which doesn't specifically mention the name of God, the other being the Song of Solomon. Yet the big question is also a clue to the messages of Esther. God isn't mentioned by name, but Mordecai points out that if salvation for the Jews doesn't come through Esther, it will come from somewhere else, and that Esther has been put in the royal household for that purpose. So in the midst of all of this, that's faith. Esther then asks Mordecai to round up whoever he can to fast for 3 days for Esther to achieve success when she goes to the king. That's prayer. Now, having listened to all of this, what lessons can we take from all of this? Well, there are a lot, but I'm going to limit them because I can see that time is racing on. First of all, God's silence doesn't mean God's absence. The fact that Purim was instigated and continues as a reminder that God is always present means that the events were recorded in a situation where, perhaps to be too explicit, would undermine the possibility of making a record at all. It's interesting to look at what we sung before I was preaching. It was about the cross of Jesus. But if we remember, and when we rejoice in, when we think about the cross of Jesus, we need to go back a few hours to the Garden of Gethsemane. And the prayer of Jesus is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus felt the absence of God at that point. But because Jesus felt the absence didn't mean that God wasn't present. For all of us, there are times and situations that we will be in when it can seem as though we're not in the presence of God. Questions that we are answering, questions we can't grapple with and can't get an answer to, situations of illness, of bereavement, of the very things that we see in the world around us. But because we can't sense God's presence, it doesn't mean that God is absent. God was completely present in the whole of the events surrounding what happened to Esther, and every Purim is a reminder that we are not forgotten by God. It's just that sometimes God lets us experience this for all sorts of reasons better known to himself. Secondly, God worked through and in spite of human imperfections. When you look and examine the story of Esther, I hope you'll read this later, the whole book, and reread it, you'll see that the whole thing is messy. It is a mess. It is the best and the worst in human experience and relationships. It's sordid, it's corrupt in places, all these things are coming out. Yet God was in it. When we look at the world around us, I'm sure there's many in this church are praying that God will break through in this nation with revival, that people will come to him. And God listens to prayer. And God's been ministering to me in recent months about the need to hang in and continue in prayer. When we are hanging in, God may well bring a deliverance. He may bring a change. But we might get very surprised and maybe even shocked by who he works through and who he works with. God isn't in any sense constrained by the expectations of the kind of people or persons who are going to bring about the changes that I believe he still wants to see in this nation. Thirdly, God's purposes and working will often take time. God's not in a rush like we are. The events recorded in Esther, they span decades. And yet, even when Esther comes on the scene, things don't change instantly. We're talking about at least a year for Esther, where she was being made up for the king's pleasure. We want things to happen yesterday, don't we? We want God to bring revival right away. God's never in a hurry. God's decisive when he wants to be and when the time is right. But he's not in a hurry. It was centuries, actually, of course, when we look at some Old Testament prophecies, when Jesus became incarnate after his coming was prophesied. In a sense, that's great, because the world was prepared by the spreading of a common language, by the facilitating of travel and roads for the gospel to spread very quickly. But God wasn't in a hurry, and he acted at just the right time for a far greater deliverance than the Jews in Esther. And just lastly, I'll say this. I wonder what word we would use to describe the times that we live in. Weird? You look at some of the weird stuff that you see on social media, it really is odd, some of it. Unstable, godless, the police forces are getting smaller. Yeah, we could go on for ages about this. Be alert. God is still working. And you know, whatever, we are here. We are being spared. We're in this place, and wherever we are taken through the week, for such a time as this. Amen.